go to design work because I like to be surrounded with women.
Thank you for tuning in to The Queer Truth, a podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me Cece, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise.
Hello.
Coming in from Scotland.
So close, but so far away.
So close, but so far away. We're on the same island, that's for sure. That's about it, though. So today is the last day of June. Pride Month comes to an end, but we just about turn up in London. Pride Month ends, and now we're ready for the turn up. But hey, that's all right. And, you know, it seems Pride was going out with a bang in North America. A lot of things were happening. I want to begin with Chicago. Of course I do. Chicago celebrated their Dyke March. And what I appreciate about the Dyke March, because I went to the Dyke March in Berlin, because we didn't have Black Pride like we have here in London. So the Dyke March was always the opportunity to go to the, you know, the anti-everything alternative to Pride, right? Anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-anti-anti. And that's how the Chicago Dyke March would call itself as well, right? It is an opportunity to have a less white gay male march for the things that still really matter. Well, it made some negative headlines last week because initial reports claimed that the Dyke March banned the Jewish pride flag. And then you went in and you read the articles and it says the Dyke March preaches inclusion, but it kicked out folks for carrying a Jewish pride flag. And a lot of people jumped on that without finding out more of the details. So I want to get into it because New York Times, you know, I'm not convinced the New York Times is left anymore. Like,
oh, no. New York Times. Well, I mean, look at what's happening in its newsroom right now, right? Like, so New York Times is, yeah, they definitely faked left. They went right.
They went all the way right. And let me tell you, I was on 10 when I read an opinion piece that was published on the New York Times. I'm glad the Dyke March banned Jewish Star. That was the title of the article. In this article, this person has the nerve to take Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, her name, into their mouth and says intersectionality.
And then misrepresents.
And then willfully misuses, misrepresents, misunderstands Professor Crenshaw's work.
Yes.
Quote, intersectionality is the big idea of today's progressive left. In theory, it's the benign notion that every form of social oppression is linked to every other social oppression. This observation sounds like just another way of rephrasing a slogan from a poster I had in college. My liberation is bound up with yours. The author goes on to write, well, in practice, intersectionality functions as kind of, should read as a kind of, but as kind of caste system in which people are judged according to how much their particular caste has suffered throughout history. Victimhood in the intersectional way of seeing the world is akin to sainthood. Power and privilege are profane. End quote. Is there any reason to dissect all the things that's wrong with that statement? I don't know. I do know that that's bullshit. And I do know that the Jewish Voice for Peace, the Chicago chapter, gave a statement that clearly outlined what happened at the event. Basically, and the Dyke
March, they
posted receipt. So the Jewish Voice for Peace wrote their own statement. Chicago Dyke March had an official statement with receipts, with text messages showing that they had been in conversation with the person who has been loudest about being asked to leave the march, Laurel Grauer, who is the regional director of A Wider Bridge. A Wider Bridge is an organization with ties to the Israeli government, and it has been protested in the past in the U.S. for pinkwashing. For those of you who might not know what pinkwashing is supporting the Israeli apartheid because of the simple fact that it has, to a certain degree, progressive politics when it comes to gays and lesbians. I would limit it to progressive politics for gays and lesbians. I'm not convinced about the rest of us. So Laurel Grauer and some other people were asked to leave after a 2-hour conversation.
Mm.
They were engaged in conversation for 2 hours. Why? Because it wasn't simply because they were carrying a flag that had the Star of David superimposed onto a pride flag. It was because of their Zionist remarks. They actually were changing the chants that state, for example, from Palestine to Mexico, they changed it from everywhere to Mexico, which led people to approach them, some of whom were Palestinian marchers, to ask more about their intentions, the use of their flag, and why they were changing the chants. Jewish allies came to their side to engage in the conversation, as well as the Dyke March collective organizers. And it was then that it became clear that they are Zionist. And Zionism is specifically not allowed at the Dyke March. What do you think?
And I also want to underscore that this was a total bait and switch, right? So there was conversation before the march that was like, look, you know what our views are. You can come, you know, if it's just about Jewish pride, of course, come with the flag, represent, no one's going to harass you. But they came with the Zionist agenda. And I think they came intentionally to provoke. I think part of what's been happening with the state of Israel, especially with regard to gay and lesbian rights, I first of all want to make it very clear that those gay and lesbian rights are only afforded to Israelis. Right. Like, so it's not across the board. Like, Palestinians are not, that live in Israel, are not afforded those same rights per se. So it's afforded to Israelis. Now, what rights they do have. So the conflation of Judaism in Israel has been a political strategy of Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that if I expel Zionist ideas and you say, wait a second, that's like this imperialist white supremacist strategy that is oppressing people, oppressing Palestinians specifically, then I can then say, oh, you're coming after me because I'm a Jew. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's this conflation of, if you're a Jew, you're a Zionist. If you're a Zionist, you're a Jew.
Mm-hmm. And that's not the case.
True.
Right.
That's not the case at all, right? Zionism is a political ideology that has Israeli state support. And Judaism is religion. And not all Jews are Zionists.
Exactly. As stated by the Jewish Voice for Peace, right? The Chicago Jewish Voice for Peace made a statement of solidarity with the Chicago Dyke March Collective. Just the beginning of the statement says, quote, as a Jewish organization dedicated to justice for Palestinians in opposition to all forms of bigotry, including anti-Semitism, Jewish Voice for Peace Chicago affirms our support for the Chicago Dyke March Collective, a powerful force for justice and queer and trans liberation in our city. While we also hear those who are concerned at the perception that Jewish participants were singled out at the march, we ask that everyone reflect on how events actually unfolded, how Israel has appropriated Jewish identity and symbols, and how that impacts our movement spaces. They go on to write in the end, as Jewish Voice for Peace Chicago, we share the Chicago Dyke March Collective's opposition to state violence, anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, anti-Black, anti-immigrant, anti-queer and trans, anti-woman, and anti-person of color bigotry. As a Jewish organization committed to justice and equality for Palestinians, we invite everybody to work with us in opposing the state of Israel's use of Jewish identity, trauma, and symbols in its oppression of Palestinians. End quote.
Yeah, I'm totally behind them. One thing that you shared with me was a seemingly queer Muslim who was supporting the wider bridge and saying, well, if I can fly my queer Muslim flag, why can't they fly the Jewish queer flag? And some things that have come out about that person, too, specifically that they're a white person that converted to Islam. And so the goals necessarily of Israel on a racial level may not be near and dear to them. They might not fully comprehend or understand that. But further
has been announced as a summer intern in New York to a wider bridge, their leadership mission.
Oh, that's lovely.
Right. But this is a post that got published quite a bit on, or shared quite a bit on Facebook. And what really was revealing was the amount of white women who, some who identify as Jewish, others who don't, who took that post and were like, exactly this. If you ban people carrying the Star of David because of the work of Israel, then you have to ban all Muslims, right? Because they are killed at high rates in Muslim countries simply for being gay. Again, there's so much wrong with the statement. I don't even have time to dissect it. But my question is, why was everyone so willing to believe the first report out? So many people were so willing to believe that report and have not made any, you know, adjustments in their stance after reading the official statement from Deichmarsch Collective, after reading other official statements from Jewish organizations and non-Jewish organizations who clearly show that there was a lot of engagement involved and still no willingness by the Wider Bridge, affiliates to change their stance. If you're Zionist and you move into a space that says anti-Zionist.
Right. Yeah. Okay, sure. But Zionism is morally reprehensible, right? So when you're coming from a stance that's morally reprehensible, the only way that you're going to win people over to your side is through subterfuge, is through you smoke and mirrors, right? Like 45 has taught us that, right? Like if you're coming with a viewpoint that no one can logically get behind, then logic's not your friend. Facts are not your friend. So you go the other route. And that's exactly where they've gone.
But the New York Times doesn't even fact check. They just allow some
Zionism
opinion piece to be
a huge blind spot of the New York Times.
That's true.
That has always been a massive, even before this new political era, Zionism has always been something that people have called them out on.
All I can say is you have absolutely missed the whole fucking point on intersectional feminism or intersectionality in general, if you believe it's a caste system.
Well, this is a wonderful example of how people take progressive language and pervert it to use it towards their own goals, right? People love to know certain buzzwords, and then they take those buzzwords and they turn it around to meet their own sort of like oppressive white supremacist, you name it, ideology. And this is exactly what this person did here.
Well, that person needs to keep Professor Crenshaw's name out their mouth.
I know that's your boo.
I know that. Well, we had something similar but different happen in Toronto. Black Lives Matter Toronto showed up at Pride Parade, and I loved every aspect of their protest. So we talked about last year how they, made the news because they issued a statement saying that they were protesting Pride Parade because of uniformed police being allowed to be in the parade, right?
Mm-hmm.
It resulted in a very controversial ban on uniformed police. In this year's parade, people even unsuccessfully tried to change that. So to be clear, police were allowed to march, but not in uniform, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Black Lives Matter inserted themselves into the parade this year. They marched with raised fists, and some of them wore black veils. And they chanted, and they stopped the parade for a few seconds at a time. And they really just made clear, this is not about registrations. I hope London Pride's listening. It is not about registrations. It is not about your large corporations paying money to be seen as queer friendly in a pride parade. It is about the people who are celebrating. What do you think? What do you think about that type of action?
Definitely that. I think getting back a little bit to Deichmarsch, I think Deichmarsches now are a bit more formalized than they used to be. But my day with Deichmarsches in DC and in San Francisco, they were ad hoc events. They were spontaneous events. We knew the day, but they weren't necessarily always registered. Mm-hmm. In recent years now, there's registration and so on and so forth. But it used to be like totally grassroots. We're just taking over the street right now. There was no police protection. There was no,
mm-hmm.
we're topless. Now, Pride had that push towards formalization much earlier. And it's so standardized at this point that people don't even recognize that Pride is really this kind of counterstructure thing. It kind of grew out of a riot. And I love the statement from one of the BLM organizers where he was talking about, look, this is ours. I shouldn't have to register for something that is ours. I began as a riot, and this is what this is. It was started by queers of color, and I'm here, right? So this idea of like, okay, well, you have to have this registration, and you have to pay this money, because there's money involved too. So that also means you have to be like a formal organization, and you have to pay this money, and then this and that. That is not what Pride was supposed to be about. Pride was supposed to be, about representing the queer community. Now, a few episodes back, I sort of foreshadowed this happening because I was like, how does one have deadlines, say that they're putting on a, right? You say you're putting on an LGBT plus thing, Q plus thing, and you have deadlines, And nothing crosses your mind like, oh, there's no B up in here. There's no T up in here, right? Like you just, so representation is on the onus of the people that you say that you're representing,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if I say, oh, okay, well, I'm going to have a mom's pride or a mommy day and no mommies are solicited to come, right? can I really say that?
Right.
So it being this kind of like the formalization has really moved it away from its purpose. There's no solicitation of these different groups or people from specific identities to come. There's no invitation. There's no tiered fee structure per se, right? So that's a huge problem. I'm glad that BLM was just like, we're here. We're going to take up space. What you going to do?
Exactly. And to quote the BLM, one of the BLM co-founders, behind the glitter, behind the sparkle, anti-Black racism still exists, and we're here to challenge it.
Mm-hmm. And within that glitter and sparkle, too, because all up in the club. I mean, like, so many instances that you and I have volleyed back and forth in the last month alone of racism in queer spaces. So, yeah, go on, Toronto, BLM Toronto, do all of that. I loved it.
Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Charlene Carruthers, who you may have heard us talk about many a time on the show. She's the national director of the Black Youth Project 100, but she's also so much more. Thank you, Charlene, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
First off, just for some of our listeners who may not know about the work that you do, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I was born and raised on the South Side of Chicago. And I now have the privilege and the honor to continue my organizing work here. After doing activism and organizing work across the country for nearly a decade, before I was able to move back home in 2013. And so in the past now 12 or 13 years, I've had the opportunity to work on campaigns addressing immigrant rights, healthcare rights, LGBTQ and gender justice work. And now, as the national director of BYP 100, I work with young Black activists across the country. Across the country, we have 8 chapters as far west as the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
As far south as Jackson, Mississippi, and as far east as New York City. And so basically, we work on the issues that most directly impact Black folks here in the U.S. And it's been an amazing journey in the past 4 years. We actually will celebrate our 4th year next month.
Oh,
next month. So that's what I've been up to.
How can we imagine the type of work that BYP 100 does? Is it specifically working with youth? And if so, is there a way that you go about finding your target audience?
If I were to describe the work that we do to give folks some flavor and texture, it's really about putting a strategy to increasing the amount of Black joy that our people are able to experience. And it's in recognition that we live in a country that systemically oppresses us on multiple fronts for being Black, for being queer, for being women, for being trans folks who are women, trans folks who are femme, trans folks who are masculine. People who are disabled, all types of ways in which the state oppresses us and uses violence. And our work is squarely about saying, this is not okay. We know we deserve more and we deserve better, and that we actually will demand things of the state while building alternatives for ourselves and with our people.
How do we go about doing that when... Because you specifically said Black joy. And it's funny that you said that, because today someone sent me something on Instagram. It was just one of those videos that's hilarious, and it made me laugh. And I just looked at it and I was like, it's amazing to me how much oppression and continued injustice Black folk experience, yet we still have so much to offer. And in light of what's happened just in recent days, obviously the non-guilty verdict coming back on the trial of the police officer who killed Philando Castile, as well as, just recent development in Seattle with the killing of Charlene Lyle. How do we not focus so much on the suffering, rather focus on our own joy?
Well, I believe that to be Black in this world is to live within a number of contradictions. No matter where you are living in this world, if you are a Black person, suffering is likely something that you are familiar with, if not you directly, that your family is familiar with. And at the same time, our people have always found ways to experience joy, to be resilient. Our cultures, our various cultures across the world. And as someone whose grandparents, my grandparents migrated from the U.S. South, what I know is that our culture is something that we experience and we live through and we hold through our food, through our song, through our dance, through our intellectual labor that we do, the thinking that Black people do to talk about the world that we live in and imagine the world that we could live in. And so I think it's our ability to do those things are intrinsic to our humanity as Black people. That's just what we do. And it shows up in so many different ways, from the ballroom scene to our artists who paint murals, to people who take care of children and cultivate them into, you know, a current generation, an upcoming generation of freedom fighters. I think our creativity and our resilience is something that is just intrinsic to being Black in this world.
And how do you think, or to what extent would you say being a Black queer woman informs the work that you do?
Well, I'm very clear that I live in a world that sends multiple messages about what I should want and what I shouldn't want. And that I live within a legacy and a tradition of struggle, of resilience and resistance of Black queer women who come before me. And so be it the first, one of the first books I read when I was a middle schooler or a teenager, Coffee Will Make You Black, by April Sinclair, to today's reading of Audre Lorde's text, building with elders like Ruby Sales and Miss Janetta Johnson, it allows me to understand where I've come from, where we are today, and like where we have to go. Queerness expands possibilities. It's beyond normativity. It's beyond what people think is okay. And I think once I accepted my queerness, it expanded what I thought was possible. And it's actually a comrade, Jessica Byrd, who highlighted that idea for me for the first time. It's just actually, queerness is it allows us to be expansive in ways that I haven't always been expansive. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what it does for me. And the experiences that I have, even when I think about wanting to become a parent, I have to think about so many things.
Right.
There's so many levels to it because my partner is a woman, is a cisgender woman. Mm-hmm. And what that means for how I will become a parent and how the state is literally set up to not allow me to do that in a way that I want to without complication. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Because I've heard you speak on a few occasions when you were on different panels and I've read interviews that other people have conducted with you, I wonder how you, in particular, how you personally define queerness. I think it's a word that's used, thrown around a lot. I think a lot of people use it academically, or they use it just as an umbrella term for anyone who is LGBT plus. How do you yourself define queerness?
Yeah, so I was talking to my dad about this the other day. My dad was born, raised on the South Side of Chicago, was in the Naval Reserves for 21 years. And he and my mom definitely raised me in a household that wasn't overtly homophobic. And so he was asking me, like, what is queer mean? And so to me, anytime someone, like any phrase or idea or word we use in movement, if we can't explain it to our parents and our family members, then it doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. Like we have to be able to contextualize it for people. So I told him that queerness has many definitions for many people, and that for some folks, based on their definition, to be Black is to be inherently queer. Mm-hmm. For some people, queerness is very much so about sexuality For some people, queerness is about sexuality and gender expression and gender identity. At the core of it, queerness is about what is not normative, what is not a part of the mainstream of people who hold power, systems and people and ideas that hold dominant power over our lives. And so in a contemporary sense, it's important to see queerness as its connections to sexuality, and I also believe to gender. And I believe that we have some frontiers that folks like Dr. Kathy Cohen, E. Patrick Johnson, and other scholars have already broken into years ago to really contextualize the connections between Blackness and queerness. And so on the basic level, queerness is what's outside of the norm. On a deeper level, or on a more expansive level, queerness is about, it can be about sexuality, it can be about gender expression, it could be about social status or identities that fall outside of, and not just white, cisgender, hetero normativity, but there are even peoples on the margins of the margins outside of that. So that's like my roundabout for queerness.
Well, because you mentioned Professor Kathy Cohen, you know, she has this greater vision of how we should go about talking about queerness and how we should practice inclusion in the queer community in order to further the demands and necessities of marginalized and oppressed people. And I think it's interesting that, or I should rather say not interesting, I don't think that it is a coincidence that now some of the large organizations in the U.S., for example, Black Lives Matter or BYP 100, are led by Black queer women.
Uh-huh.
But they're working on a very large scale. It's not specifically queer in the sense of LGBTQIA, whatever. It's addressing all types of issues from prison reform, transformative justice, and so forth. What do you think about that? Do you think her vision of bringing the welfare queen under the umbrella of queerness, bringing, you know, the killings of unarmed Black and brown men and women, bringing those things, uniting those causes, you think that's possible when already just in the LGBTQ community we struggle so much to unite?
Well, when I think about the LGBTQ community, I think about Black women. I think about Black trans folks. I think about people who don't necessarily make the billboards or, you know, work for, well, definitely people who do work for big organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, but not the CEO or the executive director of the Human Rights Campaign. You know, they're surely Black folks. And it's surely Black folks who work at HRC. So I don't want to erase those people and the work that they do. It's important. However, when we think about major donors and people who are in the top of the leadership, that's a different situation. And so the LGBTQ community is so much bigger than what we see on TV oftentimes, and what the people who make the headlines. And so for me, there's no issue that's not, it's really hard for me to determine an issue that is not an issue that impacts Black people. I can imagine that there may be one. I would love for someone to like point one out to me. And so yeah, I think that's the thing for me, is that all issues are issues that impact Black people. So if it's something that impacts Black people, it's something that I have to care about. And Fannie Lou Hamer, Mississippi, born and raised, sharecropper, civil rights legend, organizer, said that nobody is free until everybody's free. Mm-hmm. And so our work must pay attention to what the Combahee River Collective call interlocking oppressions, what many people know today as intersectionality. But we have to take that. And, you know, BYP 100, we approach it through what we call a Black queer feminist lens. But that's really about what I just said. Nobody's free until everybody's free.
When you think about what is most urgent versus what we're all working toward, which is our freedom, how do you prioritize your activist intentions for the next year?
Oh, for the next year, I'm really focused on doubling down on our work to call for investments in our communities and divestments from policing and other systems of punishment.
Mm-hmm.
Also engaging in deep community outreach and community relationship building. Reclaiming our relationship to the land through land stewardship, cultivation of the land, thinking about food systems and food justice, and making sure that when we cut any issue about the lives of Black people in this country, that we are paying special attention to Black folks who are on the margin. So that means we have to care about and prioritize ending poverty, ending the ways that we deal with conflict and harm, and creating alternative systems that don't rely on punishment, but ones that rely on restorative justice. So that's what I'm focused on in the next year.
Okay. When you talk about restorative justice, just maybe as a final point, because it's something that we spoke about recently on the show, what type of accountability processes in activist communities that are organized, maybe not as large as BYP 100, but or maybe when considering different chapters, how can we go about building accountability processes that ensure that we aren't making individual community members disposable?
Well, I think that any process that folks embark on has to be a collective process, and that we have to be really clear about what we mean when we say disposability. Because sometimes, like, every community, every organization is not for everybody. Like, it's just not.
Mm-hmm.
We can't think through a model of scarcity. I think that it's important to have processes where people can be heard, where people can be honest about what it will take to repair the harm that's been done, and that people can be honest about whether or not they can do that work to repair the harm. And if they can't, then that's okay. It's about being honest about what the situation is and committing to the process. We don't have a perfect process in BYP 100. We're working on figuring out those things. Our members are very dedicated to it, and we've made a lot of mistakes. I think what matters the most is being committed and making sure that we're not doing this in isolation, and knowing that there are people who've done this before us. And so, and people who actually specialize in this work, and not just because you're an abolitionist doesn't mean you're an expert on restorative justice. It's actually learning that you have to do, training that people do, studying that people do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just learn these things. And it doesn't mean you have to go to a university to learn it, because I don't know any universities that teach this. I do know that there are people who are experts, and I don't even know all of them, but I encourage people in your local area to seek out those folks who are conflict mediators, who are restorative justice practitioners, to learn how to go about this and do the work of accountability and community. I know what it's not. It's not replicating the same systems of punishment that are used against us, where we don't hear from people, where people aren't heard, where people are put into cages instead of actually dealing with the problem or dealing with the issue at hand. It means shutting folks down and just not listening. And I think if we start from a place of listening and a place of curiosity over one of just shutting things down, then we have a greater ability to have true accountability processes.
Absolutely. Is there any last thing that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, you know, the struggle that we're engaged in today is not new. We have perhaps new enemies who look a little different, who have different resources and access to people and information. However, most of what we need to know and most of who we need to know it from has come before us, and we would do ourselves a disservice to believe that there's a single story of Black liberation, a single story of Black resistance, and that we have to look at in some of the unlikely places to find out what's come before us in order to have an imperative for where we need to go next.
Thank you so much, Charlene.
You're welcome.
In our final section, what are we excited about? What are we looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to? What am I excited about? I'm excited about European feminist conferences coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still, the jury's out for me about like which ones I'm going to go to. You got one happening on your island. There's another one happening in Paris. It's absolutely amazing. So there's just like a summer of like queer feminism that Europe is just, you know, coming up with. There's even the Cutie Pock Festival that's happening in July in Copenhagen.
Yeah, I'm not going to that.
I know. Cutie Pock Festival in Copenhagen is very DIY, very grassroots. It's completely put forward by the people that are going to it. So you can go ahead and put forward your
proposal, whatever you want to do to actively contribute. Yeah, it's a great way to organize.
It reminds me of an APOC conference, that I went, Anarchist People of Color conference. But yeah, it's you know, I'm just glad it's happening. I'm glad that so many people are on the radar. What are you excited about?
So there, I have like 11 invitations for this weekend. It's too much going on. I can't do all of it. But
such is London.
But I am happy to announce this weekend, beginning this evening from Friday to Sunday, Africa Writes happens again. It takes place annually. A lot of African writers have an opportunity to display their work. You can buy their books. And our one and only Olumide Popoola, who wrote When We Speak of Nothing, will have a talk there on Sunday. Check her out, 12:45, and she'll be reading from the new pages. This weekend is also the Cutie BPOC Pride Picnic, doing it differently than they did last year. Last year, it was on the same day as the mainstream Pride Parade. This year, they're doing it a week before. Don't know if I'm going to make it. I got a lot of things on. And then in my own neighborhood, there is a Pride picnic on Sunday at Victoria Park. So, you know, there's so much Pride this weekend.
A lot of Pride.
Before Pride even takes place next weekend.
I'm starting to feel that London is wasted on you. I don't really feel like you have a dedication to the game. I feel like my understanding when you moved there was that you need to enjoy certain things, not for yourself, but for me. Now, it's disappointing.
I'm going to do my best.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And if you have a little bit of extra change, drop by our Patreon page, patreon.com/TheQueerTruth. Help us out where you can. Until next time, peace out.